This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. After the 2017 publication of her debut novel, Conversations with Friends, critics deemed Irish writer Sally Rooney the first great millennial writer. But 4 years later, what it means to be a millennial writer is still hard to define, if not a contentious idea altogether. According to the Pew Research Center, millennials are anyone born between 1981 and 1996, making them between the ages of 25 and 40. While the generation, like all groups, isn't monolithic, there are certain cultural touchstones that have come to shape the millennial experience, and they're showing up in literature. Joining us to talk about what it means to be a millennial writer for our ongoing series, The Writer's Room, is Kylie Reed. She's the author of the book, Such a Fun Age. Kylie, it's great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Danielle Evans. She's the author of the short story collection and novella, The Office of Historical Corrections. Danielle, welcome.
Hello, good morning.
And Lauren Euler is also joining us. She's the author of the book, Fake Accounts. She's also a literary critic whose writing has appeared in The New Yorker and the London Review of Books. Lauren, glad to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, as I said, millennial fiction is not a hard and fast genre. You wouldn't walk into a bookstore and see a millennial fiction section like you would, you know, romance or science fiction. But I'm curious to hear from each of you what you think makes some novels get labeled as millennial novels. Danielle, I'll come to you first.
Oh, okay. I think that I'm interested in how millennial fiction, insofar as it's a thing, is thinking about the future. I think part of the way that I think that this is both a useful framing and also a frustrating framing is that I think that as a generation, I think that millennials were raised with certain expectations about the future that then kind of promptly fell apart and found ourselves in some ways in a different world than we were trained for. Mm. At the same time, I also think that, you know, as a Black millennial, I'm also aware that we're the first generation born and fully born in a post-segregation United States. And so I think that for some of us, there was like a potential decrease in precarity. And then we found ourselves in sort of the same precarity that preceded us. So I find it both a useful way of thinking about the world and also a frustrating way of thinking about the world. But I think that part of what I think fiction is working through is this anxiety about the future, because I think inherently to be a writer, you have to believe in the future, right? Otherwise, you would do something that had a quicker turnaround and had more immediate payoff. And so I think that there's this way in which you are invested in the future as our visions of the future become increasingly chaotic or apocalyptic, and sort of don't either gesture toward the kind of markers of adulthood that we thought we'd have, or gesture toward the kind of markers of a future that we thought we'd have as a kind of civilization.
Kylie, what about you?
I think I would agree with a lot of what Danielle was saying, in that it's useful to explore these scenes, but it's also a bit frustrating as well. You know, the tendency for millennial fiction to, you know, get assigned to books that have a bit of a rageful woman who's a bit nihilistic and aimless. I think that those trends are very interesting. At the same time, you know, this just the term millennial fiction seems a little bit, you know, corporate and directed towards consumptions of, if you are a millennial, you will like this fiction, and that is a bit limiting. I know for my novel, you know, painting it as a millennial fiction novel is a bit reductive because, you know, there's a domestic labor in my novel, but I don't think that my novel is more timely now than it was in 1950s and 60s, when I think 90% of Black women worked in domestic jobs and in domestic labor. So there's that side of it, but there's also the side that, you know, I do think that it's a marketing tool, and there are certain books now that are painted in this picture that says, you know, when you buy this book, when it's sitting on your coffee table, it says to the world, I'm educated, I'm concerned about the world, I realize things are bad, I see nuance in simple prose, and I'm definitely not racist. I think a lot of books are painted in that way. But, you know, most importantly, I think it's so worth exploring. At the same time, I don't think that we'll have a clear grasp on what millennial fiction is for some decades. And even then, we're going to be looking back with completely different values and circumstances and understand what millennials are working through at this time.
Lauren, what about you?
Yeah, I think what Kylie just said about how millennial fiction won't cohere until, you know, sometime in the future is really true, because I also think any kind of generational grouping is an attempt to sort of historicize the present. So it's pundits or critics or whomever trying to make some kind of argument about what's happening now and what we will remember about the present. But I also think millennials seem to get it a little bit harder and seem to get marketed a bit stronger than other generations. But right before we were talking, I just did a few Google searches for terms like boomer novel or boomer literature or even Gen X novel, Gen X literature, which you do hear a bit more about. And there's really not a lot of discussion of either of those things historically or right now. Whereas now, if you Google millennial fiction, you'll get tons of articles in The Guardian and The New York Times, you know, the infamous Sally Rooney first great millennial novelist discussion that's always going on. So I think there's something special about this time that has created this kind of pseudo genre, which is to say that it's incredibly mediatized. There's so much more media, there's so much more discussion, which creates a sort of, I don't know, endlessly meta discussion of all of the discussion that then you end up kind of overwhelmed by if you are an individual writer who wants to write a book that lasts for many decades.
Well, Kylie, there are certain cultural realities that have come to shape and define the millennial generation, and all of you touched on it. Social media, lack of financial stability, the overall fracturing of this, you know, so-called American dream. How do these realities show up in your work and your characters' lives?
In several ways. There's just a basicness of, you know, my characters are living in a digital world. I remember when I was a nanny, I made the switch from my regular phone to a BlackBerry because I was missing out on jobs that moms would email to me. And so it's an adjusting to the fact that you are communicating with your employer through text messages and maybe stalking them on social media or whatnot. For Amira Tucker, who is the young woman in my novel, she is coming to the end of her health insurance. She is 25 and she's on her parents' health insurance and she doesn't really know what she's going to do at the end of this period of her life. And I love putting a clock on my characters that they have to figure something out. But what happens for Amira is she blames herself. She says, this is my fault. My friends have figured it out. I just haven't figured it out. And she doesn't really look at the fact that she has been put in systems that are meant to make people like her fail and have this struggle. And so it's been an interesting thing coming out of, you know, a year of publication, because Amira is a very likable character, which all characters don't need to be. But I receive responses from Black and white women alike who are frustrated because, you know, Black women know you have to work twice as hard to get this thing. I need you to want more. And often white women will say, oh, I just wanted her to, you know, do a little bit more and be a little bit more ambitious. And the focus is placed on her rather than the system. It's kind of like, you know, watching a horror movie and getting frustrated that the woman fell while she's running away from someone, instead of saying, well, she shouldn't really be having to run right now. And I do think that a lot of people face problems like that.
Now, Danielle, in one of the stories in your collection, it's called Boys Go to Jupiter. It centers around Claire, who's a white college student who, when a picture of her in a Confederate flag bikini goes viral, becomes the focus of her campus, and particularly of her Black hallmate, Carmen. Carmen's the one who calls her out. But the backstory proves to be much more complicated. What were you trying to unpack in that short story?
I think two or three different things. One is that I was interested, that whole story takes place in the present tense, which for me was a way of thinking about both grief and a kind of refusal to engage with history, a refusal to kind of engage with accountability. And so in some ways, there's a way in which that sort of permanent present tense is about grief, is about kind of humanizing that character. And in some ways, that permanent present tense is about privilege and about who gets to have infinite second chances and who gets to always live in the present as though the past has never happened. I think I'm interested in a couple of different things. One of them is kind of problematizing the question of empathy, right? I think that we sometimes sort of get glib about fiction and say that it's supposed to be a way of making us more empathetic and a way of giving us windows into other people's psyches. And that second part, and I certainly agree with, but I also think that it's important to understand that empathy, like everything else, kind of bends in the direction of power, right? Empathy isn't inherently an equalizing force. And there's a way in which I think sometimes as fiction writers are training to be empathetic, to be complicated, can move away from a complexity actually into this very reductive and defeatist kind of sense of, oh, you have to hear both sides of every issue and they're both equally valid no matter how actually kind of valid or what the consequences of particular actions are in the world. And so I wanted to kind of create a story in which you could invoke empathy, but also be really uncomfortable with that empathy and also be really uncomfortable with how it managed to preserve that permanent present tense. I also was interested, there is a social media aspect to that story. I think that it's always been the core of fiction to think about the difference between our public lives and our private lives. One of the things that feels to me like it belongs to writing in general as a storytelling medium is the gulf between the public self and the private self. And so I do think that social media adds this other layer to that, because as much as we all have performed selves, there's an explicit performance, right? There's an explicit investment in a particular kind of story, sometimes even an explicit kind of story that we know is not true.
We're back in the writer's room talking about what it means to be a millennial writer. Our guest today, Danielle Evans. She's the author of the short story collection and novella, The Office of Historical Corrections. Also with us, Lauren Euler. She's the author of the book, Fake Accounts, and Kylie Reed, author of the book, Such a Fun Age. Tell us what you're reading right now. Tweet us at 1A, share a message on our Facebook page, or email us at 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. And we're in the writer's room talking about what it means to be a millennial writer with Kylie Reed. She's the author of the book, Such a Fun Age. Also with us, Danielle Evans. She's the author of the short story collection and novella, The Office of Historical Corrections. Also joining us, Lauren Euler. She's the author of the book, Fake Accounts. We also want to hear from you. What do you think about the term millennial fiction? If you're a millennial, what kinds of stories or books do you feel speak to you and your experiences? If you're not, what book or story do you think captured your generation? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Here's a voicemail we got from Florida.
I'm Margaret. I'm from Fort Myers, Florida. And I like millennial fiction that talks about how weird it is that technology has expanded so much. I'm a mid to late millennial, so I grew up with a computer on dial-up, and now I have a phone that can search the internet and give me answers all I want. So everything feels a little confusing. I like fiction that speaks to that.
Margaret, thanks for leaving us that voicemail. Now, Lauren, in your novel, Fake Accounts, your unnamed protagonist discovers that her boyfriend, Felix, has been operating a fake Instagram account that pushes conspiracy theories. Talk about this struggle to reconcile someone's online identity with the one they have in real life.
Sure. I think what was very interesting to me when I was writing the book was the way people were acting on social media in various ways and how it was received. Even when people were being sort of unbelievable or they were blatantly lying, people would just sort of accept it, not only because not only for the, you know, the typical reasons that like everybody understands that you're lying, but also because that or that you're advertising something when you're posting about yourself online, right? Everybody knows that you're doing a personal brand. But also because some of the things people were lying about were so sort of banal and insignificant, right? Like if you lie and say that you had a great date or something, or you lie and you say that your child has done something really interesting and fabulous, but actually they haven't done it. And you can tell that they're lying. Nobody really cares. And I was really interested in the sort of dissonance that creates in the individual social media user. So throughout the book, this kind of big revelation that the narrator's boyfriend has been operating this conspiracy theory Instagram is kind of juxtaposed with all these little lies that people in her life and ultimately she also produce just trying to go through the world. And I think that what Margaret said in her voice message is really true, that something that characterizes a lot of millennial experience is feeling like there's something really weird and wrong about technology, whereas I think probably younger generations are not going to feel that there's this kind of disconnect between the quote-unquote real world and the virtual world.
Now, you mentioned this idea of a personal brand. Do you think that's driven by social media, or is there something else in this age that's behind that?
Oh, I mean, I think it's a natural impulse even without social media. I think in the past you had, you know, public figures in whatever way trying to sell themselves and trying to portray themselves a certain way, and you had PR and you had all of this stuff. So I think I try to think about social media as a kind of conduit or a context through which human impulses and desires are filtered, not to use too many social media words, but it just produces behaviors that still seem to me human in some way.
Well, Kylie, in your book, Such a Fun Age, your protagonist, Amira, is accused by a white patron in the grocery store of kidnapping the white child she's the nanny for. And Amira is confronted by a security guard, and the repercussions of this exchange have this ripple effect. What are some of the consequences that rise out of this moment for Amira and the people around her?
For Amira in this moment, I think, well, Amira also doesn't have social media. She's in this phase of her life where she's not super proud of what she's doing. And so, you know, when it comes to social media, she thinks, you know, what would I put on this? I'm a before photo right now. I want to wait till I'm an after to get social media. So when this moment happens, there's her experience, there's the police officer experience, and then there's everyone else watching. But then there's this really important character, which is a phone held up and recording her. And this story is about one young Black woman, not all Black women. You know, and if it was me or if it was someone else, they might have said, I want to make this public. I want to seek justice. But Amira, with where she is in her life and her circumstance, she wants to keep it very private. And she realizes that that decision isn't up to her. And she sees firsthand how the internet will do what it will with who you are through this lens. I think she discovers in a really traumatic way that, you know, who she is in that moment, not only is it not consensually shared, but she is someone else to everyone who views it. And I think a lot of people have had that experience.
Well, Amira is also a young Black woman without health insurance and whose anxiety about money is very much present on the page. Why was it important for you to write about class and money directly in this way?
Well, selfishly, I'm just very, very interested in it. But I also just think that it is such a huge part of our everyday lives, from talking about it to using words to shape the way that we're not talking about it. I remember when I workshopped this novel at grad school, I had a wonderful workshop, but one really interesting comment in class was, you know, why is everyone talking about money in this novel? It makes me so uncomfortable. And the other novels we were reading had sexual assault and really like dangerous situations or a horror movie, but mine was the one that made people feel very uncomfortable. So I wanted to lean into that uncomfortableness while making it still very readable, because I think that we're talking about money all the time, even when we think we're not talking about it.
Well, Robin tweets this, I just finished Danielle Evans' book, loved it. I had reserved it so long ago from the library, I had no idea what I was about to read. Wonderful surprise. Danielle, a preoccupation with capitalism and how characters participate in it is thought of as one of the defining qualities of millennial fiction. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that there is an expectation that we are working all the time, but less expectation that work is building towards something. I think everything feels kind of temporary or transient. So even, I mean, I work in academia and, you know, I have a tenure track job, but most of my friends my age don't, right? They have a lot of adjunct jobs. So they don't like work for an institution where they're building a career, where the expectation is at some point they'll sort of become invested in the governance of an institution. The expectation is they'll have like five jobs, and some of them will change from year to year and they'll move around the world. And so I think that a lot of industries have made that kind of move to where you're working all the time, but you're not necessarily invested in the outcome of that. The job, not that capitalism ever particularly was good at taking care of people, but I think the sort of the lie that it would sort of become very obvious. It's impossible to kind of believe that you're working with an institution as opposed to for an institution in a lot of situations in which it might have been possible to feel that you were, or in some cases, maybe even actually be.
Lauren, your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I totally agree. And I think that that we, the millennials, sort of came of age, depending on how old you were, in 2008 with the financial crash, which was followed by Occupy Wall Street. And I think also something that sort of characterizes us is a heightened awareness of all this. So you get a lot of millennials talking about capitalism, and you get, you know, to the extent that they're making jokes about it, like there are tons of very funny memes, right, about all these kind of quite serious, almost abstract concepts. And I think that is very interesting to me in the context of thinking about, you know, work and gig work and your idea of a future, which can be it's hard to imagine your future anyway, and then you sort of think about it theoretically, and it becomes even more difficult to do so.
Well, we got this tweet from MJ who says, "I am a millennial and an aspiring fiction writer. I'm loving this convo. I agree that themes of what's real and what's marketing will be a huge theme for our generation forever, especially because digital misinformation and radicalization isn't disappearing soon." And another of you wrote this: "Authors like Sally Rooney describe the experience of my friends and I in a way that feels almost cringy. It's almost uncomfortable to see how hard everyone is trying all the time and all the spaces on social media and in real life where we are trying." Kylie, what do you make of that? This idea that how social media, I guess the disparity between social media and real life, but how everyone is trying really hard perhaps to project a certain image.
I think cringy is the word for sure. And social media is just another place where it's deployed in a really interesting, weird way. I can't remember if Lauren or Danielle said it, but we are this generation who went from just, you know, talking to people to doing it online and having a certain online persona. And I think that transition is an awkward one. I don't know how else to describe it, but when I'm watching a television show on, you know, HBO or whatever, and they're showing text messages or little bubbles of an Instagram post, it embarrasses me. And I don't know what exactly that emotion is, but that's what I am looking for, you know, fiction writers to accomplish. It feels like we're trying to be relatable via social media. There's too many second hands that we're working through. And so on one level, I love authors that explore that cringiness. On the other level, sometimes it's hard to read.
Lauren, what about you?
Oh, I mean, I think making readers cringe is one of my favorite things to do. But of course, that's because that's what life is like in so many different ways. And I think something that's interesting about social media is that you can watch people embarrass themselves in so many different ways, like, and then watch them try and fix it also. And because I think there's this impetus to share a lot and sort of process things out loud and kind of, you know, be open and honest about things, particularly, I think authenticity is something that's associated with millennials as well. You then a lot of the times you notice people not stopping to realize, oh, maybe this problem would be better dealt with in private instead of in public. And so it does, I think that also contributes to this cringe thing that Kylie was talking about and that the reader was talking about as well.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're back in the writer's room talking about what it means to be a millennial writer. With us, Kylie Reed. She's the author of the book Such a Fun Age. Also with us, Danielle Evans. She's the author of the short story collection and novella The Office of Historical Corrections. And Lauren Euler, author of the book Fake Accounts. Christopher tweets this: "I'm looking forward to millennial fiction that rejects old romantic tropes of he swept me off my feet, he just knew, and instead scripts women in full ownership of their desires, and men model the negotiation by charm via enthusiastic consent. Please ask for examples to read." Danielle, any advice here for Christopher?
I too, I guess, would like to read that book. I think one of the sort of interesting things about romance and gender and millennial fiction and maybe just culture in general right now is I think that we have raised a generation of women to ask for things that we haven't necessarily trained the world to give them. Mm. So that disconnect is interesting. And I think that disconnect is making its way into fiction in the sort of fracturing of tropes or and just people who want different things. I mean, I'm also interested in the number of millennial books that, or books in general right now that are about friendship. I think it's interesting because we think a lot about fiction in terms of the marriage plot, right? Which is like a, it's an inherent plot. There's an action, either something happens or it doesn't. And I think that the friendship plot is really interesting because it creates an interesting kind of ongoing rhyming action, right? Because you don't have to have an event to end in friendship. You just have to somehow stop doing it. You can have a dramatic event to end a friendship, but it doesn't inherently require a plot. And so often there's this interesting kind of resonance if you look at long friendships and see, you know, who was this person then and what changed, what made this friendship sustainable, or what creates a breaking point, which is often not drama, but a kind of subtle shift in characterization or just a choice not to invest in the friendship anymore. So I'm interested in how many books are really also about the long space of friendship rather than this idea of romance as a kind of terminal point.
Any titles that come to mind that you might want to direct Christopher to?
Let me think about
that. And we will tweet out some recommendations after the show at 1A. I wanted to get to circle back to something Danielle and Kylie that both of you talked about a bit, and that's the fact that Black millennials are in their own unique and precarious position, you know, two generations removed from Jim Crow segregation. They have this new kind of freedom, yet are constantly reminded that freedom is hanging in suspense. How are each of you thinking about writing Black characters coming up in today's world? Kylie, I'll come to you first.
You know, something that I consider a lot when writing Black characters is obviously just making them very interesting, you know, wonderful people, even if they make a lot of mistakes or have terrible thoughts. I think that those are all, you know, wonderfully human. But something that I do think a lot about in terms of millennial Black characters and what authors contend with is this rise in, you know, terminology like, you know, Black excellence and Black queen and you're a lady boss and all of these, you know, very like high accolades that Black people are meant to, you know, strive for, when really that's just not all Black people. Some days I like to be very, very ordinary. And I think that everyone, despite, you know, their wanting to be a lady boss of some kind, should have, you know, dignity of life and healthcare and all of those things. And so I think it's a hard balance to show Black characters in a way that does them justice, but also doesn't do the trope of, oh, this model minority who has a lot of upward mobility, so you get to see her rise, but also not, you know, a Black woman at the top who, you know, is having a problem with her marriage, but has no agency at all. I think it's an interesting place to be in as a writer, and especially to see what readers expect out of your book as well.
Danielle, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm interested in the way that we're still working with structural power dynamics and also have sometimes very intimate power dynamics. I think a lot of my work is in that space of interpersonal interracial interactions that are still very charged, sometimes because there is still a structural power dynamic where like one person doesn't realize the degree of performance or control or power they have over another person. Sometimes just because even in intimate spaces, it's possible to not understand how people are seen or unseen. I will say, to go back to our social media conversation in defense of social media, I think one of the things that's interesting to me about it is that we have more access now, I think, than ever to other people's in-group conversation, which I don't know that it has been as transformative in a positive way as it could be, but it seems that at some point it could, right? I think it makes transparent to a certain degree the performance inherent in code switching, because you can see how people talk to each other when they're not talking for you, if you're an audience that's used to being performed for, right? You can sort of learn things that you'd never have access to as an external group member just by kind of quietly watching. I think the problem is a lot of people like don't participate in social media through a lens of quietly watching. They participate through like thinking every conversation is for them.
We're back in the writer's room discussing what it means to be a millennial writer. Joining us, Kylie Reed. She's the author of the book, Such a Fun Age. Danielle Evans, author of the short story collection and novella, The Office of Historical Corrections. And Lauren Euler, she's author of the book, Fake Accounts. Jason tweets, the term millennial fiction reminds me of the term grunge in so many ways. It's a sweeping marketing term that lumps a very diverse set of artists into a single genre. Well, you can share your thoughts. Tweet us at 1A, leave a message on our Facebook page, or email us at 1A@WAMU.org. We'll be back with more in just a moment. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. Now let's get back to our conversation on what it means to be a millennial writer with Kylie Reed. She's the author of the book Such a Fun Age. Also with us, Danielle Evans. She's the author of the short story collection and novella The Office of Historical Corrections. And Lauren Euler. She's the author of the book Fake Accounts. One of you tweeted this: I'd be interested in your panelists' view of how millennials and millennial writers compare to the lost generation authors of a century ago. Lauren, I'll come to you first.
Sure. Well, I guess I don't know. I don't know that much about the lost generation. But I think, you know, my novel takes place in part in Berlin. The narrator starts out living in Brooklyn and then she moves to Berlin. And I think there are increasingly a lot of millennial novels that take place in Europe or have writers who are expatriating. And that's in part because we live in an era of increased globalization and international travel is easier. And I think also there's a real awareness of the lost generation and a sort of nostalgia about them, particularly about France. And I think there's always an attempt to make Berlin the new sort of Paris in the 20s, right? So because it's a very open and interesting kind of bohemian culture there. So I think that there's an interesting connection to be made there. That's my comment.
Danielle, any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm thinking about this because I think on the one hand, like, we're not a post-war generation, but it also seems incorrect to say that. I think that we haven't yet talked about a thing that I think is looming over a lot of our lives and writing right now, which is the climate, right? Which is not a war, but is, I think, where it feels like the apocalypse might be coming from. Not the only place, but I think that the sense of sort of being unsettled by a faith in the future that feels unearned in that way, maybe there's an echo of the lost generation in terms of not knowing how to sort of move forward in the way that your education or training or values have prepared you for, because it's sort of uncertain what's on the other end of that. I'm also just interested in what's going to happen with this particular kind of brief moment, because I think on the one hand, no one ever wants to read about that pandemic again. And so I've been thinking about how, like, all of the sort of articles about how the Spanish flu disappeared from literature, but is haunting it in all kinds of ways. And so I'm interested in how this kind of micro moment will haunt fiction, because I don't know that anyone's going to want to come at it directly, which may also create some parallels that we haven't seen yet.
We got this tweet from Jose who says, as a millennial fiction writer, I feel technology, capitalism, and the unrealistic expectations of our generation will continue to come up in novels reflective of the time. And Kylie, that phrase, the unrealistic expectations of our generation, really stood out to me. What's your response to that?
You know, the first thing that came to my mind when he talked about, you know, fiction novels talking about capitalism is not so much fiction or millennial fiction engaging with capitalism, but engaging with people who like to talk about capitalism, maybe correctly, maybe not correctly, but, you know, just making sure that people know that they are concerned with this as a problem, whether their voting, you know, habits show that they want to end it or not. But yeah, unrealistic expectations. I think that might be a trait of what is happening in so much fiction by millennial writers. There was a moment in my novel where Amira sees one of her friends in a button-down and a pencil skirt. And it's an outfit that she always thought, like, oh, I will wear that one day when I reach adulthood. But then she has a moment where she thinks, you know, I am an adult, and that's not really where my career is going. I wear jeans and a t-shirt, you know, because I don't want to get, you know, anything on my clothes. And so what does that mean for me as an adult? And so those unrealistic expectations are real, for sure.
Lauren, I want to read an excerpt from your book. Your protagonist muses, people often say my generation values authenticity. Reluctantly, I will admit to being a member of my generation. If we value authenticity, it's because we've been bombarded since our impressionable preteen years with fakery, but at the same time are uniquely able to recognize, because of the unspoiled period that stretched from our birth to the moment our parents had the screeching dial-up installed, the ways in which we casually commit fakery ourselves. We are also uniquely unwilling to let this self-awareness stop us. What is your protagonist saying about her generation here?
Well, I think she is saying, basically she's talking about this sort of enlightenment moment that I think many millennial writers talk about. I think the first person I read talk about it was Tao Lin many years ago, which is to say that there's, if you are a millennial, you can remember being a child or a young teenager and getting the internet. So you have this kind of cutoff point where, and I think that this is where this weirdness that we were talking about earlier comes from, where you're like, oh, you thought your life was going to be this way. And then in fact, it was totally opened up for you in a way that maybe even your parents didn't understand because they were, you know, had lived their whole lives without this overwhelming accessibility and ability to communicate with people. And I also think that this, you know, this is what makes us feel like we're like at a flashpoint, right? And we're this generation that everybody wants to talk about and thinks is very important. And also I think it has made us, that sort of awakening has made us extremely skeptical and kind of cynical in some ways, but also we still want some for ourselves, right? We can see the whole landscape and don't have any illusions about it. But the question of how to live, which is always, I think, what fiction writers are dealing with, is not easily answerable.
Well, your work has been criticized for having a protagonist who is overly self-aware. How do you respond to those critiques?
Well, I think to me, self-awareness was always considered a good thing, first of all. I thought that that was what you were supposed to be, because otherwise you're putting your foot in your mouth all the time, you're offending people, you're, you know, walking around like a doofus, looking kind of stupid. But also, I think, for me personally, when I'm thinking about myself and trying to, like, see myself from the outside and place myself in a situation in order either to not offend people or to just kind of, like, think clearly about something, it seems to me that that's the way a lot of people go through the world, and I wanted to represent that, and I wanted to represent, I think that if you're going to paint a portrait of this time, which is part of what I was doing, what I was trying to do with the novel, you have to have that in there. Otherwise, I think there's an element of sort of disorientation that is lost.
In her essay in The New Yorker entitled "Has Self-Awareness Gone Too Far?", Katie Waldman criticizes millennial fiction for writing characters who are rewarded for, quote, doing the moral work of feeling bad. She writes, quote, "Sally Rooney, like her character, seems content to perform awareness of inequality, even to exploit it as a device, but not to engage with it as a profound and messy reality." Danielle, what's your response to that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that there's this way that we were raised on the idea that awareness in and of itself could somehow create change. And I think that part of what we're seeing is a reaction against that, right? That sort of self-awareness doesn't necessarily create change, that awareness of the world doesn't necessarily create change, that we can have a lot of information about the world, about ourselves, that we can have a lot of emphasis on understanding things, and none of that can, like, do anything to actually move the needle on anything. So I think that that's a kind of related, like, failure to reckon. Like, what do we do with all of this information? What do we do with our desire to kind of translate things into facts and publicity? And why is it so hard to actually get all of that to result in anything meaningful? I think it is because of that gap between, like, what we know and what we're willing to actually contend with.
Kylie, what about you?
I think I would agree with Danielle there. I think that, you know, I want to explore this a little bit more, but more than I see, you know, traits of millennial fiction, I see in this present moment a certain response to the book on its terms. I see an instinct of people to read millennial fiction and say, okay, I need to get something from this, and this book needs to say something to me, and I need to leave with a little bit of a to-do list that makes me feel good, especially with, you know, engaging with Black authors who are millennials. It's okay, this book needs to make me feel uncomfortable, but then make me feel like I'm an ally. And I think that, you know, a trait of millennial fiction is a hopelessness and an aimlessness in the world that we live in. That doesn't always mean that there's a message to be received. Sometimes I love when a novel kind of works on my heart a little bit and doesn't give me those answers. So I think ascribing answers from a text is a little bit limiting.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're in the writer's room talking about what it means to be a millennial writer with Kylie Reed. She's the author of the book, Such a Fun Age. Also with us, Danielle Evans. She's the author of the short story collection and novella, The Office of Historical Corrections. Also with us, Lauren Euler, author of the book, Fake Accounts. Here's a message we got from North Carolina.
Hi, my name is Jacob. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina. I'm responding to the prompt about what I look for in literature as a millennial. I think as the descendants of consumerism and capitalism of the 80s and 90s, I don't really feel like I have much of a cultural inheritance. So I look for a lot of literature to tell me about how people form not only their own identity, but like a collective identity.
Jacob, thanks for leaving us that voicemail. Danielle, what's your response to Jacob about this search for collective identity among millennials and perhaps finding it in literature?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that as much as I feel some anxiety about the term millennial, about the term millennial fiction, that I do think that we maybe have as a generation kind of embraced it, partly almost as a joke, right? Partly, you know, the response to all of the avocado toast memes was to say, okay, fine, to sort of embrace in an ironic way all of the sort of negative traits that were ascribed to us, like what are millennials killing today and all of those kinds of sort of jokes. But I do think part of what's in there is a desire to have some sense of community or identity, to have some sort of sense of we're going through this together when a lot of us feel more alone than ever. And I do think that sort of, you know, there are so many ways in which it is possible to, or by choice or by force, to live an independent life. And that independence can be really amazing as a person. It can be really amazing as a writer in terms of the possibilities it opens up for fiction. It can also be enormously lonely. And I'm not saying that we're the first generation that's ever had to contend with loneliness. Obviously, that's like at the core of so much literature. But I do think that that idea of trying to figure out what it means to be an identity is maybe part of the more sincere part of this kind of branded marketing term millennial. Like, why as a generation we're so invested in trying to tell you who we are because we're trying to figure it out.
Well, Kylie, you know, many of the writers and protagonists of millennial fiction are women. What do you think this says about the qualities that have come to be associated with millennial fiction and how they intersect or overlap with gender?
Oh, Lord, I don't know. well, on one end, you know, women do read more than men do. And you know, if you have, you know, published a book, you know that publishing houses are filled with women. So on some level, that's not too surprising. But I do think a trait that we're seeing in fiction right now is a really intimate look at human behavior in everyday instances and who's in those places is mostly women and when it comes to domestic matters. But of course, you know, I could go off on a whole thing, you know, Jonathan Franzen writes about, you know, a domestic case and it's like, oh, this is talking about bigger ideas. And then, you know, if Alice Munro has a dinner scene, it's, you know, she's really writing about the war, but it's, oh, this is a domestic place. And so I do think that there's a little bit of conflict there of like who's writing about what at what time. But, you know, perhaps it's because women are in these spaces of entry-level jobs and childcare and feeling like they don't have agency in a relationship that seems relatable at the moment, but I'm not sure.
You know, it's interesting in hearing all three of you talk, there is this undertone of darkness in many of the novels we've referred to, and for a generation grappling with, you know, financial precarity, the climate crisis. Lauren, how much room do you think there is for optimism?
Oh, I mean, I'm like probably not the best person to answer that question because I think my novel ends up at a quite dark, there's not a sort of note of hope at the end of my book. And what I was thinking about when we were talking about, you know, trying to form identity in the world, well, what I think fiction in particular can do, to go back to something Danielle was saying much earlier, is reflect interpersonal and individual lives within a kind of broader social reality. And what's interesting to me to work on, just on a sort of level of craft or like on a practical level, is using plot and using, you know, using the sort of bigger structural elements of the novel to contradict or counteract what an individual character might feel or think. which is to say that you can say a bunch of different things at the same time in a novel in a way that I find quite much more difficult to do in nonfiction than in nonfiction. It's much harder to do it in nonfiction than in a novel, is what I mean to say. Mm-hmm. But basically, I think you can put some optimism in there while still being quite dark. Sneakily.
Well, that's it for our conversation today. Our guest, Lauren Euler, author of the book Fake Accounts, Danielle Evans, she's the author of the short story collection and novella The Office of Historical Corrections, and Kylie Reed, author of the book Such a Fun Age. Kylie, Danielle, Lauren, thanks for hanging out with us in the writer's room. And just a reminder, we will be tweeting out a list of recommendations from these authors. Follow us on Twitter at 1A. And a quick reminder to subscribe to the 1A podcast. It's where you'll find our best guests and stories every day. Get it wherever you find your podcasts. Today's producer was Haley Blassingame. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.